Let me review very quickly what we were doing in the last session. This is the unit on philosophy of art, aesthetics, and the questions that we raise here have to do with whether or not there is any objective value in art and whether or not there is an objective meaning that a work of art is able to convey. And we pointed out that factors that need to be taken into account in dealing with these questions are the mood of the individual and the general cultural conditioning that we all experience, and also the particular kind of art object with which we are involved. We pointed out that it would be unfair to compare apples with oranges, to compare, for example, Beethoven with the Beatles. It's necessary to look at the particular kind of artistic work that one is talking about and then draw evaluations of greatness or difficulty within those categories. And we pointed out that factors that are going to influence this will be the cultural conditioning of the individual. African art is not the same thing as Flemish art of the 16th and 17th centuries, and also the mood of the individual. If you're in a romantic mood, somehow Handel's Messiah is not going to be just the thing for you. Or conversely, if you are in a very spiritual frame of reference, Nat King Cole is probably not going to be just the thing, even though within the framework of what Nat King Cole is doing, he is surely one of the greatest. And in the framework of what Handel is doing in The Messiah, this is at the top end of the spectrum. We raise the question as to whether it's possible for a work of art actually to create a mood, not just to reflect one. And the even more important question, is it possible for a work of art, visual or auditory, to rise above the cultural and actually have a universal impact? Is it possible for a work of art, let's say, to create the right kind of mood or the right kind of impact universally? And all of this, of course, carries us to the question of criteria. What are the criteria that would be able to justify a work of art achieving the sort of thing that we're saying is possible and that we would want to encounter in our own artistic experience? Well, what kind of criteria? At the end of the last period, we indicated that there are no magic formulae. The golden section, for example, cannot possibly be a formula that would allow us to say that any work of visual art that has it present is great, or that a work of art not having it couldn't be. So we have to move on in our determination of criteria. And the first possible criterion beyond a magic formula is the use of extrinsic information about what the artist was doing that can shed light on the value of the result. And here I want to quote from Paul Ziff. That's Z or Z-I-F-F. And this is fairly involved, but I think it's important. Says Ziff in a work on reasons in art criticism. Suppose we are in a gallery with a friend looking at P's painting. He sometimes admires the work, is inclined to claim it is good. We wish to deny this, to claim that it is a bad painting. We might attempt to support our counterclaim by saying, the painting is clearly disorganized, offering this as a reason in support of our opinion of the work. It's disorganized. Saying this to him would be a way of drawing his attention to the organization of the painting, to the lack of it, a way of pointing to this aspect of the painting, saying, notice this, see the disorder. Not merely this, of course, but at least this. Here you see a single great curving diagonal holds together in its sweep nearly everything in the picture. And this diagonal is not built up by forms that are the same distance from the eye. The forms are arranged so as to lead the eye gradually backward until we pass out of the stable into the open air beyond. This is a statement of Roger Fries discussing a painting by Rubens, focusing the listening eye on the single great curving diagonal, drawing it back and forth across the picture plane, leveling the attention, directing it freely throughout the painting. This pointing is a fundamental reason why the painting is clearly disorganized as a reason, and the fact that it indicates why the work was executed while the artist was in Rome, conforms to the artist's intentions, is liked by Bernard, even though possibly relevant to us as an appreciation of the work. These are quotations all from that critic. These are not reasons why the painting is good or bad. For all this is not directly relevant. One cannot contemplate the fact that the work was done while the artist was in Rome in the painting. I mean, looking at the painting, you can't tell that it was done in Rome. This is not an aspect of the painting, not a characteristic of which one can either look at or look for. Suppose one were told, notice that the work was done while the artist was in Rome. One could only reply, but what am I supposed to look at? Huh? If you say to a person, notice that the work was done in Rome, looking at the painting, of course, doesn't tell you that the artist did it when he was in Rome at all. Of course, one could do this. I could say to you, think of Rome, then look for things in the picture that will fit in with what you have just been thinking. You might find a great deal in some pictures, little in others. If I want you to make out a lion in a picture, which you seem not to have seen, I could say, remember the work was done in Africa. The artist was much interested in animals, etc. So it won't do in one sense to say that remarks like, notice that the work was done while the artist was in Rome, are not reasons because they do not direct or guide one in the contemplation of the work. But in another sense, it is obvious that such remarks do not guide or direct one in the contemplation of the work. To suppose that they do is to suppose certain familiar locutions to be signifying or some in extraordinary ways. Now, the conclusion of this from Ziff. What is important here is one looks at paintings. Nothing can be a reason why a painting is good or bad unless it is concerned with what one can be, that what can be looked at in the painting. Unless it is concerned with what one can, in some sense, see. Okay. All right. The upshot of this is that we can discuss external considerations, such as the artist was in Rome, or the artist was in Africa, or whatever. You can bring these things up, but they can't be reasons why the painting is good or bad, because they can't be seen in the painting. The painting has got to judge itself in the final analysis. Okay. Well, if magic formulae don't work, and if extrinsic information about what the artist was doing or the musician was doing don't work, what really is going to help us? Yes?
I just had a question. Simply from the standpoint of, I guess we could all agree that external information makes us appreciate something more. And it's coming to my mind on the Chicago Museum of Art, there's a particular sculpture in there. I think it's called 180 or something like that. I'm trying to remember, but it's basically like a mound of brightly colored candies on the floor. And by itself, I was like, what is this? But there was actually a tour going through. The tour guide was talking to explain it. She took like 15 minutes to explain all these amounts. This is actually supposed to commemorate a friend of his who has cancer. And his idea is like the interconnectivity of like the whole human race. So they're going to take a candy. The candy is replaced. It actually constitutes 180 pounds continually. And it was really interesting. The whole idea, and there was something about his sexual orientation in there too, but like there was all this information about it, and I would have never been able to fully appreciate just rightly wrapped candy wrappers unless she had said something, but now I can see why it's a work of art.
Sure. Now you have gained something, but you haven't actually gained it from the painting. You've gained it from the description that she has provided while you are looking at the painting. So, let's say she's not around. And indeed, no one is around who can give you that information. You can look at that painting from now until just after the Last Judgment and never get any of that. And therefore, strictly speaking, it isn't fair to use that information to determine the value of the painting, because the painting exists independently of that information. That's the point Ziff is making. He's not saying that with more background information you can appreciate a painting more, but appreciation is not the same thing as value. Okay, fair enough?
So in terms of something called an art, it must have value, not just that we can appreciate it.
Sure.
Are we trying to constitute a definition of what is art here?
We're trying to determine how you would establish the quality of the painting. All right? Okay? This distinction is really important because many, many people confuse these two things, just as many people confuse their own subjective happiness or joy in contact with a work of art, with the value of the work of art. And it may be that these don't connect at all. You know, it may be that if strawberries are your favorite fruit, if it's the thing, and you go into an art museum and there is this bowl of strawberries, you are deeply moved by this, but that doesn't really say that the painting of the strawberries is any better than the painting of the plums in the next room. Yeah.
What if the background information is available to look up, but it's not included in the art? For example, T.S. Eliot's poems. Initially, just reading them sometimes they make absolutely no sense. But if you actually look to what he's alluding to and the imagery and the history behind those images, then you can understand it so much better. And it's not like it's a tour guide explaining it. It's just a cultural information that you...
Well, it's not a tour guide, but it certainly is qualitatively of the same sort. It's a commentary. It's a commentary. And the question is, without the commentary, would this be able to convey that significance? It seems to me the same point is valid here. Take for example, James Joyce's Ulysses, all right? Ulysses, without any background information as to what in the Sam Hill the author was doing, is almost incomprehensible. Now, once you have all this background information, you think, oh, how clever he was. He worked this idea in such a way, and he combined it with this, etc., etc. What does that say? It says that you have a very intelligent individual using paper and pencil. I don't think it says anything about the end result as a work of art. In the case of Eliot, there is some obscurity in Eliot, but in general, this stuff can be derived from the work itself without the benefit of all of that background information, or at least enough can be gained that you see the tremendous impact of this. Then, when you have the information along with it, that fleshes it out, adds to your pleasure and enjoyment. But I don't think that the background information here, any more than in the case of the painting, is the determinative factor. I don't think it can be. unless you want to enlarge the definition of the work of art somehow to embrace the background information as well. And I think that's kind of dangerous, because what background information are we talking about? A painting, you know, is generally in a frame, and a piece of music ends when the orchestra conductor puts down the baton. And I'm not sure you can bring in all the rest of that and combine it very effectively. Yeah.
What if you take, for example, one of Shakespeare's plays, and it can be a very beautiful piece of art that you have an understanding of the human experience. But say if you have a non-human, like a robot or something that would observe it, would have no understanding of human experience, it wouldn't make any sense at all. So in that sense, it's like human experience respects outside information that you're reading.
Well, not quite. I wouldn't put human experience in the same category as this helpful tour information or helpful literary commentary. The human experience happens to be the way people are. And that can be limited to a culture, it can be limited to a particular style of life, etc. But that's built in to the observer. And everybody comes to a work of art with that. So that's perfectly okay to use. Okay? All right. Now, you'll excuse me for dashing on, but I've got so much stuff to present in this period, and we've got to do it because we've got papers that are going to be coming up. Yes. All right. What about using the intention of the author as the guide? This has been suggested very, very widely as a way of getting at the value of the work. What's the problem with this? The problem is that often a great artist or a great musician doesn't really know what he's doing. Or what he thinks he's doing is not what he's actually doing. The classic example of this is Sibelius. I think I mentioned this earlier in the course. Sibelius just loved to have people come to his home so that he could explain Finlandia. Right? And after an hour with Sibelius, people would go away with a splitting headache and never be able to appreciate the work again, because Sibelius' explanations were off the wall. The issue is not what the artist thinks he's doing, it's what he actually ends up having done. Right? Suppose, for example, there is this wonderful picture of a dog, and you say to the artist, you know, that's wonderful, and the artist says, yes, it's the best cat that I have ever painted. Now, the artist may think that he has done a cat, but in the last analysis, this is going to have to be evaluated as a dog no matter what he thinks he did. There may be a parallel here with prophecy, with biblical prophecy. It says in the New Testament that the prophets wrote not knowing what they were writing in many instances. That is to say, they weren't aware of the real significance of what they were doing. And yet this stuff was, the inerrant word of God. It's possible for people to do things without being fully aware of the nature of what they're doing. And may I add this for those of you who are in the political arena? There is all this talk about original intent, isn't there? Original intent. All you've got to do is to find out the original intent of the authors of the fundamental American constitutional documents, and everything is fine, because then you stick with that. Is it the original intent of the author, or is it what he actually ended up putting into those documents? I say it's what he actually ended up putting into the documents, even though he was intending to do something else. And I think Robert Bork is not correct when he says you look at the original understanding of the audience when the stuff was originally written. That original intent has to do with the way the audience responds to these fundamental documents. No, I think that the original audience could have been three sheets to the wind. They could have been in pubs in Williamsburg drinking themselves under the table and not really understanding what the stuff said. It's what the documents end up saying objectively that you want to focus upon. Intent, maybe that's what a lot of people mean by original intent, going to see what the documents actually say. But the danger of this is to shift the thing back to what Madison was thinking at the time or what Jefferson was thinking at the time. And often what one actually does is different from what one intends to do. There is a little adage in the law. It's not what you aim at, it's what you hit that's important. If, for example, I intend to shoot the postman and it turns out to be the fireman because my eyesight is poor, it's still murder. It doesn't make a particle of difference that I didn't intend to kill the fireman. The fact of the matter is, it's what I hit that's important. Yes?
Regarding what you just said about the original intent, wouldn't you say that we can't actually get to simply the plain meaning of words because we'll always approach it with some sort of cultural framework? For example, the cultural framework that our Supreme Court justices view the Constitution says that homosexuality is okay. And because they have that cultural framework, they see the words as meaning a certain thing. Wouldn't it be better to approach it with the cultural framework that was used at the time of drafting it?
No. You don't do this by cultural framework. What you do is expect that any literary work and any work of art has an inherent meaning that is not contingent upon a cultural framework, and that's determined by doing grammatical, historical analysis of this stuff. It's the same problem for the interpretation of Scripture. Can Scripture legitimately mean 33 different things according to the cultural background? Should it be taken always in terms of the cultural background of the Jews of the first century? No. You take it for what it says. You let it speak for itself. You let it, in fact, criticize the cultural conditions of the time. There's a lot in Scripture, as a matter of fact, which goes against the cultural style of the first century. And so instead of doing what a religious liberal does, take the cultural framework and force the text into that context, what you do is you listen to the text even when it criticizes the issues of the time. This is just the principle of letting the text speak for itself rather than subjecting it to whatever the cultural conditions are that come along. Of course we go to all texts and all works of art from our own background, from our own perspective. But the question then is, do we let them critique us, speak to us, or do we do it the other way around? What is primary here? Remember, you go back earlier in the course, we talked a bit about the hermeneutical circle. Is it true that we and any text or any art object are locked in together so that we never could get an objective understanding of what the work actually is doing? I say no, we can. Its approach is a limit, but theoretically we certainly can do this. We are not locked into texts as a result of our cultural conditioning, necessarily. And a mark of maturity is to be able to distinguish the text from our cultural conditioning so that we don't let the two get so mixed up together that we can't be sure what we're doing. What I'm suggesting here is that we go with objective considerations that come from the work itself, and this involves two things. First of all, it involves the subject matter, and secondly, it involves the technique or the treatment of the subject matter. All right, the subject matter. Here, if we go back to the classical rhetorical tradition, we arrive at people like Longinus. Longinus did a work entitled On the Sublime, and that was influenced very much by Aristotle's rhetoric. And the essence of Longinus' position, and Aristotle would probably agree with this, is that the greater the work of art, the greater it will approach sublimity. Sublimity. It will be sublime. What does he mean by sublime? Well, he means that it will deal with the most important human issues. That would be putting it in modern terms. He would say with the most noble subjects. The most noble the subject matter, the most impactive the work of art. Now, we have to be careful here, because if you use the term noble subjects, it may make you think of lofty in the sense of important in the human scheme of things, drawing pictures of knights and counts and emperors rather than drawing pictures of dustmen and postmen and students. Professors, not students, surely. All right. Now, the trouble with thinking of sublimity that way, of course, is that the sublime doesn't have to connect with the lofty, the important in the human sense. Give you an example of this. John Updike's series of rabbit novels, which you may or may not have come across, those center on a middle-class fellow, rabbit, whose great moment in life is his success on the basketball court while he is in high school. And from there on, it really is downhill. The whole rest of his life is downhill from that. And if you describe this as subject matter, it looks pretty grubby. But the fact of the matter is that Updike is able, through the character of Rabbit and his relationships, through his life, to get at some of the most fundamental issues that one can treat in terms of the human condition. Updike happens to be a believing Christian, by the way. If you go to my Suicide of Christian Theology, I have quoted his great poem, Seven Stanzas at Easter, dealing with the resurrection of Christ. The reason why Updike is not read by Christians is because he's preoccupied with sex. And, of course, all Christians know that sex is dirty. And you don't ever treat anything like that. When I first taught at a theological seminary and assigned the first of the Rabbit series, there was a big fuss. And this thing, they wanted to take it out of the bookstore. Hmm? We finally compromised. It was put under the counter, and students could come. Students could come, and they could ask for it. Huh? Oh, great. Yeah. Well, anyway, we don't mean by sublime that it can't deal with what appears to be trivial, but the subject matter in terms of the treatment of it will be of such a nature that it will deal with the most fundamental and significant human issues. And, what does this mean? It means that if, at the heart of the human condition, is our having separated ourselves from God Almighty, if we are living in a far country, east of Eden, if that's the case, and if the only way out of this is through what God has done in Jesus Christ, coming down to earth, dying for this grubby little planet, if that really is the case, then any work of art that touches those themes will necessarily reach the greatest level of sublimity. And isn't this why the greatest art in the world has been art dealing with biblical themes? Isn't that interesting? The great architecture has been the architecture of cathedrals. The great music has been stuff like Handel's Messiah. And in the literary field, works like Melville's Billy Budd being a Christ figure. This has impacted people even when they are not Christian, because it's reached the fundamental levels. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, for goodness sake. Why has that had such an impact? The theme of redemption is the theme of that whole business. It's a Heilsgeschichte, a history of salvation. Yes?
That's simply because it addresses this doesn't make it good art, right? Does it? Because, like, if I go up on the whiteboard and draw a cross right now, that doesn't...
Exactly. And that's why I'm about to go to the matter of technique. It isn't just the subject matter, it's also the way in which it's presented. Surely, the two factors have got to come into it. By the way, this in what I've just been talking about seems to me explains why when you go into a museum like the Louvre and you see a wide variety of paintings, you spend very little time with the nature paintings, the fruit plates. There are rooms in the Louvre in which there are a variety of these paintings of fruit. In the 19th century especially, people had a fruit mania in the artistic area. And, you look at these and, and on you go. Because they have not touched, really, the heart of the human condition. Now, if you were a fruit fly, your reaction to this might be different. But for most human beings, that isn't really great stuff, right? But then you get you go on to the paintings that do impact you. Well, what about technique? Well, the technique has to be really grand as well. There's no doubt about that. I don't have time to go into the details of what constitutes great technique, and that obviously varies with the particular artistic area. Musical technique is not the same thing as visual technique. But I give you an example or two. Poetry. It isn't very difficult to distinguish between the Little Willie poems and Paradise Lost. Little Willie. Little Willie, with a lust for gore, nailed the baby to the floor. Or, Little Willie in the best of sashes fell in the fire and burned to ashes. A little later, the room got chilly, but nobody wanted to poke up Willie. Now, that's poetry, everybody. There is also, of course, The Night Before Christmas, etc. But compare that with the following. The cherubim descended, on the ground, gliding, meteorous as evening mist, risen from a river or the marshy glides, and gathering ground fast at the laborer's heel, homeward returning. High in front advanced, the brandished sword of God before them blazed, fierce as a comet, which with torrid heat and vapor as in the Libyan adjust, began to parch the temperate clime, whereat, in either hand, the hastening angel caught our lingering parents and to the eastern gate led them direct and down the cliff as fast to the subjected plain, then disappeared. They, looking back, all the eastern side beheld of paradise, so late their happy seat. Waved over by that flaming brand, the gate with dreadful faces thronged and fiery arms, some natural tears they dropped, but wiped them soon. The world was all before them, where to choose their place of rest, and Providence their guide. They, hand in hand, with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way. That's the concluding lines of Milton's Paradise Lost. Listen, that is great stuff, and it's great stuff not just because of the content, but because of the magnificent use of epic poetical technique. Yes?
Can technique also be based on our culture? Like, for example...
You're a cultural sort, aren't you? Yes. You go cultural.
I don't know that we can completely divorce ourselves from our culture.
Of course we can't. No one said we could. The question is simply whether we let that determine the end result, or whether we are able to evaluate it and judge it by the nature of the stuff. See, something like Paradise Lost was done in the 17th century. Here we are in the 21st, And that hits us just as hard as it hit anybody previously.
But don't we see it technique-wise? We view it as that was a good example of the technique used in that century, but we wouldn't use that same technique in this century.
Well, but I think we would find that technique as valid no matter what. And if you combine that with the content of this, you take the two things together, you've got something great that will grab people in other cultures as easily as it grabs us. Hmm? The Chinese, they like this too. This has impact on them. Hmm? Now, music within your own frame of reference. Those gospel songs that are presented with overhead project. I'm so happy today. 18 times I'm so happy, right? And of course we're happy. Contrast that with this. Thou whose almighty word chaos and darkness heard and took their flight, hear us, we humbly pray, and where the gospel day sheds not its glorious ray, let there be light, etc. Five verses of this. The content is, of course, a great deal deeper than the gospel song, though there are gospel songs that have excellent content. But where the presentation is concerned, along with the content, as here, you've really got something. And this goes beyond our local cultural situation. And I think it's capable of creating the mood and not simply reflecting it. Well, this takes me to an overhead or two, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. At the top, you have three examples of portraits in our time. All right? Portraits in our time. Gino Severini, that is a self-portrait. Poor fellow. Then, in the center, we have Hanna Hirch. That's mother. Oh, my goodness. No wonder Freud wrote what he did. And then at the far right, Picasso again, le chapeau à fleurs, the flower hat, the hat with flower. Really? And there we have Rembrandt's self-portrait as an old man. Rembrandt was a very handsome young man and painted himself at that point. And here he is old and he is tired and he has suffered all sorts of problems. And as you look at him, somehow those difficulties, what has made him the person he is, comes forth to you. You're moved by this. And the longer you contemplate it, the more moved you become. Next. I thought that, yes. All right. At the top, we have a Matisse. This is Matisse, La Tristesse du Roi. The sadness of the king. The king is sad. All right. Okay. Really? Why couldn't it be the happiness of the charwoman? I think it could be, with a little bit of imagination. It took me a lot of imagination even to get to the sadness of the king. And here at the bottom, we have Albert Dürer's famous painting of Melancholia. This is an angelic figure with all sorts of wonderful scientific, artistic, and literary possibilities represented in the painting. And melancholy has come upon that figure. Now, if we compare that with the sadness of the king, I think it's obvious which is going to last. And finally, on the left, we have Bill Viola, whoever in the blazes he is, who did this in 2001, and it's called Five Angels for the Millennium. Five Angels for the Millennium. I have difficulty in seeing more than one, but, you know, angels are difficult to pin down, and, you know, there may be a problem along that line. Yes. And on the right here, we have a portion of a painting that if you go to Strasbourg with us on our program, you will see in the Unterlinden Museum in Colmar. This is part of the great Grunewald altarpiece. This happens to be the Annunciation. This is the angel Michael, who has come, and he is announcing the birth of our Lord. Now, I do not get into questions of how the technique achieves what it does, but I tell you that the technique is vital. These various pictures I've been showing you all have similar themes, in this case, angels, right? So I am simply saying technique is important as well. Now, I want to play for you one example from Johann Sebastian Bach. And I'm doing this because Bach is generally regarded as the greatest. I realize that, isn't it Schneider who in the Peanuts cartoons who thinks that Beethoven is the greatest? Am I right? Yeah. Here, for example, Paul Hindemith, the great composer and conductor, said this. He said, in the limited realm of musical enjoyment, which in spite of its own beauty is again a symbol of our whole faculty of perceiving, digesting earthly experiences, recognition of the summit once and forever means that from now on we cannot perceive any structure of sound without measuring it against those values which, in this case, Bach has demonstrated. It will make us intolerant of lesser music, idle tinkling, uncontrolled and unskilled composition. If music has the power to direct our existence toward nobleness, this music is great. If a composer has dominated his music to this point of greatness, he's achieved the utmost. This Bach has achieved. Many historians of music say that after Bach, the Western musical tradition had no choice but to go along different lines because Bach had perfected the classical musical tradition. Well, what I'm going to do here is to give you a selection from Bach's cantata for the 200th anniversary of the Reformation. This is based upon Luther's A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, Ein Feste Burg Ist Unser Gott. This is going to work, I do believe. By the way, this diagram here is supposed to point out that a work of art should, the dot should really be down here in the center. A work of art works in relation to our personal mood, our cultural framework, and the question is, can it reach universal human experience? Right? And a particularly important thing is whether or not the artwork can influence, by its own nature, the mood and the cultural framework and transcend it. All right, let's see what we can do here. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And Yes. The whole chorus is 221 bars in length, a masterpiece of massive choral and orchestral writing.
Shh, 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 shh. No, I don't want the rest of it, Steve. The two, quit iTunes there.
Okay. 221 bars in length, a masterpiece of massive choral and orchestral writing in keeping with the sentiment of the words. It opens with three trumpets, drums, violoncello, and organ manual, the pedal being silent for the first 23 bars. At the 24th bar, the pedal enters with a 16-foot psalma and makes a bold canon of 8 bars, etc. The analysis of this in terms of the technique is on a level that is incomparable with other musical material. And as I mentioned last time, the remarkable thing about this is that theologically, this is the stuff directly from the Reformation and therefore directly from the New Testament. And in Japan, Bach societies are forming all over the place and people are being converted. Bach, the fifth evangelist. This is only one illustration. We could take Handel and other great musical selections as well. It's a combination of sublimity in the sense of hitting the human condition at heart with the only solution possible and masterful technique. These things can bring the artwork to the point of universal human experience. All right, that's it.